Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to 10% Happier early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. This is the 10% Happier Podcast. I'm Dan Harris. Hello, my fellow suffering beings. How are we doing today? One of the quickest and easiest ways to get happier is to be generous. And to be clear, I'm not just talking about money here. It can be holding the door open for somebody, calling a friend who's struggling, giving a compliment. You get the idea. There is an enormous amount of scientific research to suggest that being generous, financially or otherwise, has significant psychological and physiological benefits. Not for nothing, the Buddha often instructed his followers to train in generosity before he had them do any meditation. So the case for generosity is pretty damn strong. That said, there are a ton of thorny questions that arise out of this simple proposition. If giving is so obviously helpful, why do so many of us struggle with it? And why is the subject often so boring? How do you give wisely and effectively? How do you make sure it's not going to waste? How do you get past the stinginess and second thoughts that many of us experience immediately following an impulse to give? And here's a sticky one. If you're being generous in part to make yourself happier, is the presence of that self-interest a corruption of your generosity? Chris Anderson has spent a lot of time thinking about this. He's the curator of TED, basically the guy who came up with the idea to make TED Talks free and widely available and subsequently a huge cultural phenomenon, a story that quite obviously links to the subject of generosity, by the way. Chris has a new book called Infectious Generosity, the goal of which is, in his words, to make a good thing less boring. We talk about how to create a generosity mindset, the audacious and daunting goal he recommends for your annual giving, and the promise and peril of the internet, which he says can dramatically amplify human kindness, but is too often used to amplify human cruelty. He's going to talk about his ideas for fixing this. Just a heads up that at times there are some sirens in the background of this recording. We were in New York City together when we taped this. This show is brought to you by BetterHelp. I got to tell you, I feel so much better when I talk about my anxiety instead of keeping it bottled up. There's an expression that I first heard from the great researcher and also Zen practitioner Robert Waldinger, never worry alone. Our temptation many times is to keep it bottled up, but the data really show that the people who do the best in life, who live the longest and are the happiest, have strong relationships with people with whom they can talk about whatever's going on in their lives. And for me, therapy is part of that. If you're thinking of starting therapy, you might give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/happier today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/happier. You can count on T-Mobile to help keep you connected after investing billions to light up their network from big cities to small towns. T-Mobile is America's largest 5G network. Plus, when you switch to T-Mobile, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus Verizon and AT&T. Visit your neighborhood store or T-Mobile.com to switch. Plan savings with T-Mobile. Third line free on essentials via monthly bill credits versus comparable available plans. Plan features may vary. Credits stop if you cancel or change plans. Chris Anderson, welcome to the show.
It's great to be here, Dan.
It's a pleasure to have you here. I'd love to hear a little bit of the story behind this book. Why generosity?
So, in one way or another, I feel like I've had this topic on my mind my whole life. I've most of it actually feeling guilty about it. You know, my parents were missionaries, actually. Their whole lives were sort of devoted to a cause bigger than themselves, serving the Lord in this case. And I felt terrible that I couldn't live up to that. Like, I really wanted to be a good person, but it was hard. And early on in a church service I went to, I heard the speaker who spoke about how when he came home from his work in a refugee camp, even though he was exhausted, he would remember that there was a child who was suffering more than he was. And so he had to continue his work. And I was so depressed by this because it felt like generosity was like, if you started going down that road, you would be hit by unlimited demands and you would never have a guilt-free night in your life. And so I didn't know what to make of it. So that's one thread of us sort of wanting to be generous, but also feeling guilty about not doing enough. Especially in a connected world, by the way, when you know that you can just go on the internet, you can find some cause or someone on the other side of the world who needs that $5 that you're about to spend on a latte more than you do. Can you ever have a nice cup of coffee again? So there's that side. But the bigger thing that happened, I guess the aha moment for me was that I ended up in this crazy position where I got to take over TED. And, you know, I was an entrepreneur. TED was a conference I went to, fell in love with. My business blew up in the dot-com crash. To some extent, it just about survived. It's still going today. But I left, and a foundation that I'd set up when I had some money was able to buy TED. And so I spent the last 20 years running it and seeing this transition from a conference to sharing talks online. And I guess the generosity touched every single step of that process. I mean, first of all, the conference I bought felt like it was an engine running on generosity. Speakers weren't paid anything to come. The audience was incredibly generous in its response to speakers. There was something weird about, instead of a usual industry conference, it was three different industries coming together: technology, entertainment, design. And people somehow wanted to connect with each other and understand each other and give to each other. And it just felt different from other conferences. So there was that. But the real thing that happened was that when online video came along, we suddenly thought, oh, we could, if we chose to, share these talks with the world for free. And we're a foundation and we're supposed to be acting in the public good. Shouldn't we do that? And the other part of me was screaming, no, you're going to kill the conference. Why would people pay the money to come if the talks are free? So we had this debate, perhaps because it was a foundation and not a business owning it. I don't know. We started giving the talks away, and to our amazement, they went viral and they actually increased demand for the conference. So I started thinking, wait a second. In this connected age, the rules seem to be changing. What you give away and what you hold on to is changing. And we started to adopt this as a strategy for running TED. Radical generosity. So we gave away our brand, TED, and people could do these TED. We made them add the letter X to it, but you could do a TEDx event anywhere in the world for free on your own time and financial risk. And from a business strategy point of view, traditionally it was crazy. Harvard Business Review actually wrote a piece on it, how TED lost control of its crowd. But it was deliberate doing that. And by giving up control, something truly amazing happened, which is 3,000 events started to be held around the world. It's probably 60, 70,000 people right now working on TEDx events somewhere, unpaid by us. They're taking their own risk. They're putting in so much blood, sweat, and tears into it. And we get 25,000 videos a year. You know, some of the best TED speakers you've heard came up through TEDx. You could never do this without the sort of strategy of just giving things away. So I guess I became a bit obsessed with that, as in this connected age, generosity could play a larger role. And it's complicated because there's payback to you. You get back.
Right.
You know, like we've always been told, given you shall receive. It's really, really true now in a way that more so than it has ever been. And so I guess I think that in this connected age, everyone should be more generous and be amazed at what happens next.
You brought up something that you cover in the book, and it's a provocative question, at least in my mind. If you give with the idea of getting something back, is it no longer generosity?
So this is a classic philosophical problem that people have long asked. Immanuel Kant, the philosopher, argued very directly that no, generosity must only be done out of a sense of duty. If there's anything else, it's not real generosity. And I used to, as a philosophy student, I used to literally lie on the floor in my room and agonize over this question, because I wanted to be a generous person. And yet, when I was generous, I did it for a reason. It felt good, solving my conscience. And I did actually feel better afterwards. And so did that mean that it wasn't generous? That fell off, because if that was the case, how could you ever persuade anyone to be generous? I feel more strongly now than ever that we actually have to let go of that sense of pure motivation. And instead of looking for reasons to criticize someone's generosity, actually do it the other way around. Look for good motivation in people, and you suddenly discover that the world is a lot prettier place than it should be. I mean, if we can celebrate the fact that someone can be generous and at the same time know that their reputation may be enhanced and know that they may feel some extra happiness at the end of the day and may know that people may respond to their generosity, that is awesome. That is not bad. That is awesome. And we should celebrate that. And that is how the world will get more generous, because we will all realize, actually, this is not just the wonderful Sunday school good thing to do. It is the smart thing to do.
Well, I tend to agree with you. I mean, I absolutely agree with you on purity of motives being almost, in most cases, out of reach. Hmm. We are complicated creatures, and there are many motivations, many of them unseen. So that all makes sense to me. But on this note that we should celebrate people who give in almost any circumstances, are there no circumstances that are kind of beyond the pale where it's just transparently transactional in some way?
Yes. I think if it's transparently transactional and someone's literally doing it purely for self-promotion, or, you know, they're trying to get themselves out of a sticky situation where they've really been bad, and sure, you don't have to call that generosity. But that's not what the world is doing right now. What the world is doing right now is choosing to be super cynical about a lot of acts that are actually very well intended and are good. So, I don't know, Bill Gates flies to a conference somewhere, and it's like, you flew to a conference in your own plane. Well, anything you did then was disgusting. Or, and by the way, why did you start the pandemic for your own personal gain? That is where the world's coming from. Whereas if you have a different set of facts, like say you knew that Bill Gates actually was using carbon zero fuel, that he had paid three times the normal price for his plane so that he wouldn't contribute to footprint, and that he spent the flight doing what he often does, which is just read in absolute depth to try and really understand a problem in the world, and that he'd spent more than almost anyone trying to fix some of the big global problems, then you have a different view of him. And it's, you know, when Bill Gates first started doing the Gates Foundation, it is entirely possible in my mind, I mean, I haven't grilled him on this particular question, it's entirely possible that part of it was motivated by the fact that his PR was in trouble. Mm-hmm. You know, Microsoft was the big evil empire, you know, monopolist, whatever. And he had his father's voice speaking at him and Melinda Gates speak. You know, who knows what the motivations were? The fact is that part of his motivation, for absolute sure, is a desire to make the world better. And the same curiosity that he applied running a business was applied to really understanding some of these problems. And the sincerity and depth of his intention is clear, along with other things. So we have to have a more sophisticated view. We have to be able to celebrate people while also saying, okay, and now how about this? Could you do that better? That's okay as well.
That all makes sense. So make the case to us. Well, one of the things you said, I believe, I don't know if you've said this widely, but you, in conversation with Lauren Smith, who's the producer of this episode, she was talking to you before we started talking, and you said one of the goals of your new book is to make a good thing less boring. And that really stuck out to me. So one way I think we can make it less boring is by really making the case on what is in it for us to give from a scientific standpoint, from a physiological standpoint, from a reputational standpoint. Can you do the sell?
Sure. And the first thing to say is generosity obviously is not just about giving money. That in some ways, that's the least interesting part of it. There are so many ways to be generous, starting with just a generous mindset, and then many acts of human kindness, of gifts of time, connection, hospitality, so forth. So we're talking not just about money here. So the scientific case, I think it starts from this. We are wired to be generous. We are a social species that scientists disagree exactly the process about how this may have happened. But we feel each other's pain. When we see another human suffering, we want to do something about it. And it's, in one way, it's weird why that should be so. Like, if you're wired for survival, why should that be so? Well, it turns out that a social species survives a lot better if its members are kind to each other. So that is a raw feeling, and everyone who's ever seen something on TV or whatever, where you've seen someone suffering and you've cried, that is a weird piece of biological magic happening in you that is a key part of the generosity engine in you, because that will make you do things that you wouldn't otherwise do. The second thing that's amazing is that we're wired to respond to generosity. As part of one of the things that was the sort of catalyst for the book was I got this inside view of a thing called the mystery experiment online, where 200 strangers on the internet were given $10,000 each, no strings attached, except that they had to report on what they spent it on. And what they spent it on, two-thirds of it was generous. Two-thirds. People might expect 10%, 20%. They gave away, in some form or other, two-thirds of that money. And, you know, that's thrilling. And it doesn't even have to be generosity that you receive personally. If you witness generosity, someone else doing something kind to someone else, that can create a measurable sense of uplift that will change your own behavior as well. So all of this, to me, is exciting. And then the fourth piece of science that is absolutely crystal clear in the numbers is that generosity carries with it happiness. It's, in some ways, it's a sort of a veiled form of happiness. I don't think we always see that going in. You know, if we're contemplating being generous, what may be top of mind for us is the loss aversion feeling of, I really don't want to give this thing away. But time and again, when people do give things away, they end up being surprised by happiness. And in fact, there was an amazing Gallup study that looked, I think it was 230,000 people. One of the questions they asked was whether people had given away something the prior month to a charity or a cause or to a stranger or whatever. And the happiness that they got from that, according to this study, was equal to the same happiness as if their income had doubled. I mean, that's an astonishing amount of happiness. And by the way, it seems like for most people in most circumstances, it's a much easier pathway to happiness. Because not many people can double their income. Everyone can actually be generous in some way. So yeah, so you know, that is one key thing that is in it for anyone, is that you will end up feeling better about yourself. And you'll have a sense of meaning and happiness if you go that route. And in this connected age, it's not the only thing that happens. Gifts can go further than they've ever gone before. They can basically replicate and travel across the world. And they carry with them reputation. Reputation is the most important currency of our age. So, I mean, again, my inside view was what happened at TED. No one knew about TED 20 years ago. And then we started giving stuff away. And then a few years later, lots of people had heard about TED. And that reputation has really been what's driven everything since. So I think that can apply to individuals as well, and to organizations. There is a lot in it for you to be generous, as well as there being a lot fighting in your head to stop you doing it. If we could win that battle and flip it a bit, the world becomes a much kinder, lovelier place.
You touched on the kind of the role of the internet and our connected age in making generosity, to echo the title of your book, infectious. And I do want to get into that, but let me just stay on a sort of more basic level for a second. When it comes to the benefits, I believe there's also been some neuroscience that looks at people's brains when they're giving, and it shows things like the part of the brain that lights up when you give something away is the same part of the brain that lights up when you eat chocolate. and this has been called the helper's high or something like that. Does any of this sound familiar to you?
I think there is science that does that. I don't discuss that particular scientific study in the book. I'm surprised that it said it was the same part of your brain as when you eat chocolate. Because to me, eating chocolate is pleasure. The happiness you get from generosity, there's probably some pleasure in it, but I think it's deeper. I think it goes to a deeper sense of meaning and fulfillment, honestly.
I might have just mangled the evidence too, because I just pulled that out of my head. So that's always a possibility on this show. I want to follow up on something else you said, which is this blocker, this hesitation we often feel when confronted with a generous impulse. Before I let you talk, I'll just relay a little story. There's a guy who's been extremely influential for me, who listeners to the show have heard me drone on about ad nauseum. His name is Joseph Goldstein. He's a great meditation teacher. And he has this little rule, which is, this is only a rule for himself, but he'll talk about it as something he recommends to others, which is, as soon as he notices a generous impulse flit through his mind, he will tell himself, I'm going to do this, no matter how many second guessing thoughts come up subsequently. He just says, if that first instinct arises, I'm going to do it. And he says he's never regretted it. And I've tried to take this on with some degree of success. But so with that as some context, what do you say to those of us who might feel generous sometimes, but then go back to, oh, I need to put solar panels on the house, or, oh, I need gas, or whatever it is?
I don't think it's easy to be generous at all. And especially many people are in situations where they feel, probably rightly, that they're in a struggle for survival. Their only duty is to themselves and to their family. I've got no beef with that at all. And in fact, being kind to your family is a form of generosity. I think there are many different ways to be generous. And I think a lot of the challenge is to know ourselves better. Often what gets in the way of the generous act is not the sort of external circumstances of this is no way affordable and no time. It's more just our own addictions, our own sort of, most people, a lot of the time, we sleepwalk through life, just doing a routine, doing what seems natural, going from one thing to the other. And we forget the bit where you pause and reflect and you try and find your better self. And there are lots of ways to be generous. So paying attention to that generous instinct. You know, you're walking down the street and someone annoyingly asks you for money and you feel uncomfortable and you're late and so you want to move on. That's okay. But sometimes stopping, looking at the person and even like getting a chance to hear their story. I mean, I'm an awkward introvert and I'm pretty uncomfortable around people. But just occasionally, I found the time to listen and stop and hear someone's story. And you kind of, it's moving. And you end up then maybe giving them something not out of guilt, but because you like them, mm-hmm. you know, or you, it just feels different. And so it's this process of finding a generous mindset, paying attention, and then seeing where that journey takes you is at the heart of so many inspiring stories of generosity, many of which end up with huge ripple effects. You know, I describe at least two stories in the book of people where the stories have started that way and they've ended up spinning out into, you know, one man, John Sweeney, ended up creating this global business of suspended coffees where he, you know, he encouraged anyone who goes into a cafe to be able to pay forward a cup of coffee for someone else. All started with conversations on the street with the needy people. And they felt seen, he felt seen and good about it, and ripple effects happen from it.
You mentioned this term generosity mindset or generous mindset, and you have a lot of great advice in the book about, you know, tactical advice about how to establish this kind of mindset. So I just want to signal that we're going to get to that.
Okay.
But let me stop for a second on something you just said about yourself, which is that you described yourself as introverted and slightly awkward. You picked a funny line of work if that's your factory setting.
Yeah, because I curate a conference and see lots of people. And so the mingling part of the conference is actually the hardest for me.
I see.
Like I can do it for an hour, but after that I do get stressed. And it's like I crave escaping. I feel like I'm letting people down by not talking. What's interesting for a lot of introverts, actually being on a stage isn't that hard because you're not, it's a structured environment and you're in control of what you say. And so that's different. I think Susan Cain, who wrote the book on being an introvert, gave a brilliant TED talk, you know, and was so comfortable on stage and amazing. So those things aren't incompatible, but definitely, like for me, a nightmare is trying to make small talk at a party or at a bar. I can't do it. I'm really bad at it.
Yeah. I would describe myself as extroverted, but small talk in certain circumstances makes me uncomfortable too. So, I mean, you're not a mutant if that's...
Okay. Well, that's good to hear. Thank you, Dan.
You may be in other ways. I don't want to rule anything out yet. But let me just go back to the homeless thing, or unsheltered is the term now. I don't live in the city anymore. We moved to the suburbs, so I've fallen out of this habit. But I used to, through meditation and developing some degree of self-awareness, it became clear to me that this is not my preferred term, but I'm going to go with it, heart hardening that one has to do to ignore the homeless people who populate this city with some degree of intensity, depending on the neighborhood. In order to ignore them, if you're paying attention to what that's like in your mind, it's counter-evolutionary. I mean, right back to the beginning of your comments in this conversation, we evolved to be in social intercourse with other people. And if you're, we evolved to feel their pain. And if you're shutting that down, it doesn't feel good if you're paying attention, even though, of course, it's quite natural. So I was taking an online Buddhist course and one of the teachers recommended that if you live in the city, you should carry around a bunch of ones in your pocket. And so I started doing that. Again, I've fallen out of that habit, but just to know that I had the ones and I could make eye contact, give them some money, tell them, you know, have a great day. That little, and there's a scientific term for this, micro interaction, that little micro interaction, that moment of generosity and connection, leavened my day in ways that are hard to describe. Does that land for you?
It does. And I think everyone can, there's many different legitimate ways you can come down this. Like some people want to be more strategic about it and say, look, what I care about are the underlying causes of homelessness, and that's where I'm going to make my focus. And throwing around a bit of money here and there is only going to increase dependency and whatever. So let me do my research and write a much bigger check to a bigger cause that's trying to solve the underlying. I'm fine with that too, if someone wants to go that route. But there is something special in just noticing in yourself the difference between a generosity mindset that is willing to open up. It's willing to accept that feeling of discomfort, mm-hmm. but that is also a feeling of human connection. And by the way, for some people, there's a legitimate question of danger in some circumstances. So, there's no judgment for someone who says, no, I can't do that because I don't feel safe. That's all right. And I think, by the way, that same another circumstance where I wish that people would more consciously and proactively look for that generosity mindset is online. If you're in an online environment, and often we're sort of prompted to feel anger or annoyance or whatever, and all these little text zingers go zipping out there on the internet of snark about someone or whatever. There, if you could find the human interaction, say, wait a sec, the person who did this is a human being. They've got their own story. They've got their reason for feeling this way. Why don't I just respond with just a little more kindness and respect, and or just curiosity, ask a question. And if we could shift 10 or 20% people to do a bit more of that, you know, we're a social species, and the whole framing of what happens online starts to shift. And I see some evidence of when that can happen. In some communities, it happens more easily than others. But that, again, it's just a mindset difference. Mm-hmm. It's just the shift of looking for the good in people instead of looking for the bad.
I agree. A thought popped in my head while you were talking about, you were making the case for those who are comfortable with it to have that moment of interaction with somebody who might need the help on the street. Mm. And I'm just wondering, like, for people like us who feel uncomfortable sometimes in small talk, what if we reframed that as an act of generosity? Would that make it easier?
I'd have to get comfortable with thinking that my small talk would actually be of interest and to someone else. But it's
not like the talk, it's the attention.
It's the attention. So small listening.
Yes.
Yeah. No, I think that's good. I think that's good. And I think that is a gift that anyone can give, just to look someone in the eyes and listen to them. Tell me your story. That is generosity.
Yeah. I mean, I wasn't saying that. I was really directing it more at myself, because I haven't experienced you as awkward or not wanting to make small talk. Maybe there's a lot going on beneath the surface and times I've interacted with you, but I can definitely interpolate back into my own experiences and think about, and I've been criticized for this, of not making time for like junior staffers or and things like that, because I'm too focused on my own shit and whatever I've got to do or whatever I believe I have to do, as opposed to just relaxing and viewing micro interactions as, it's not a noblesse oblige. It's not like, oh, I'm bestowing my precious attention on you. It's actually enlightened self-interest, right back to the heart of this conversation. Because if you can have positive interactions throughout the course of your day with anybody, it's going to change the weather in your mind.
I think that's right. It's often a memo to myself that I have so much room to improve on that as well. I get impatient and walk away from people who I should just sit down and spend time with.
Look, no judgment here. We were the only people in this room, and both of the people in this room have plenty of things to improve on. And I would imagine that applies to anybody listening. All right. So let's go back to the role of the internet, because you talk a lot about it. And I think it's really interesting. I believe, and please correct me if I'm wrong, that a huge part of, again, the book is called Infectious Generosity. A big part of the infectious piece of this, which you believe is novel and good, is that in a connected age, our generosity can ripple beyond the act itself. Am I stating that with some accuracy?
Yeah, no, that's exactly it. So it's really two things that came together for this. One is just a deeper understanding of some of the psychological pieces that are in everyone, have always been in everyone, of you know, we're wired to be generous or wired to respond. But when you connect those things to the fact that we're in this age where we're all connected with each other, that creates so many more opportunities for generosity to be expressed, and at much, much, much bigger scale. So, I mean, you know, the big insight for me was that, you know, so pre-online video, Ted did actually occasionally distribute contents online, and it was in the form of DVDs, and they cost $2 each. And, you know, so to have a talk that was viewed by 100,000 people would be a massive investment. Mm-hmm, it couldn't really happen. in this connected age, all of those distribution costs of sharing anything that can be shared online, which, as I'll mention in a minute, is actually much of what we actually care about, it can all be done basically at less than 1/10,000th the cost of what it was a mere 20 years ago. You know, it's like orders of magnitude. It's basically free. And you put it out there and any number of people can view it or receive it. So that creates potential for all these amazing gifts. And you say, oh, it's just online stuff. Yeah, but what are we talking about here? We're talking about knowledge. We're talking about how to do something, the learning of something. We're talking about great pictures and art and aesthetic experiences. We're talking about free software that you could give away to people. I mean, if you actually look at what we spend time doing, so much of what we'd spend time doing is absorbing or thinking about or using non-material things. All of those non-material things can be shared freely at an infinite scale on the internet. So put that together. In principle, you can have a world where millions and millions of people are engaging in either giving or receiving things or seeing other people do that, which carries with it its own sense of uplift. So you have all these potential ways in which generosity could spark further generosity. And I mean, this is why, you know, in the early days of the internet, people were so optimistic about it. This is the technology that can bring the world together. We can have empathy like we never had before. We can do things for each other like we never could before. And the tragedy is that in many cases, that has been swamped by other things going viral online called things like, you know, fear, resentment, mistrust, anger, disgust, outrage. Those things, because of the weirdness of human brains, travel faster, more naturally than the good things. So I guess the fundamental question in the book is, can we do something about that? How can we outwit the darker side of what spreads with a sort of a deluge of stuff that shows the good side of humans? Can we find a way to do that? Can we find a way to make good not boring? Can we find a way to spread the right kind of infections online? And I think by looking at what's actually happening out there under the radar, there is a kind of playbook you can put together for how that might happen.
Much more of my conversation with Chris Anderson after this. The weather is getting warmer. Time to ditch my jackets and sweaters for shorts and tees. I used to waste my money on clothing that would only last one season. That was until I found Quince. Now I've got high-quality pieces that never go out of style that I will be wearing year after year. Quince has all the seasonal must-haves like 100% European linen shirts from $30, performance polos, and versatile flow-knit activewear. The best part, all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to us. And Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices, along with premium fabrics and finishes. I just made a big order at Quince.com. I got two pairs of sweatpants that I've just had for like a week, and I already love them. I'm wearing them all the time. Sweatpants are a huge deal to me because I work from home and I want to look reasonably good, you know, in front of my wife and stuff, but I want to be comfortable, and the Quince sweatpants do the trick. For me, the bottom line is they've got good looking stuff at low prices. Not a bad recipe. You should go ahead and upgrade your wardrobe. Go to quince.com/happier for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/happier to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/happier.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/happier. Just go to Indeed.com/happier right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/happier. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
It's Mental Health Awareness Month, and while meditation is good for your mental health, it can also be challenging. The 10% Happier app makes starting meditation easy. Download the app for free wherever you get your apps.
Have you followed the work of Mr. Beast?
Yes. Yeah. So I write about him, and he is a classic case of someone who has understood and figured out what it takes for, I'm going to say, good things to go viral at massive degree. I mean, here is one guy and his team who every video they put out now within a few weeks is like 100 million views. Not in history has there been a media company worth billions of dollars that can do that. What he has discovered, like he has cracked the code of YouTube. And, you know, a lot of what he does, so for people who don't know, you know, he creates videos about amazing, wacky, incredible, fantastical scenarios. Some of them aren't to do with generosity particularly. They're just, let me show you what a $1 house looks like and then what a $100 million house looks like. Let's go right the way up the scale. And at every stage, you've got an audience that is sort of jaw-dropping at the sort of breadth of experience that he's willing to joyfully throw himself into. But he applies it to generosity as well and has, you know, okay, here's how we dug wells in 100 African villages, or here are 1,000 people whose eyesight I restored. I think some people are irritated by him because we're in a cynical age and people go, yeah, but that's a little bit self-promotional, or yeah, but that's not really tackling the underlying cause of the problem. Well, so, but is it better that he did it than that he didn't? You know, talk to the people whose eyesight was restored. Talk to the tens of millions of people in the next generation who are coming to believe that generosity can be cool and fun and that they aspire to do it. And talk to someone like Millard Merg, who I met, who was inspired by Mr. Beast and who is another influencer online. So he saw this trend on TikTok of food waste being dumped, like huge globs of massive amounts of peanut butter dumped and exploding on a kitchen table, and felt disgusted by it. And he said, okay, I'll show you what this could be. So he got huge quantities of peanut butter and jelly and made them into like 100 sandwiches that he wrapped, took them out into the street, gave them away. His video was seen way more times than the trend he was taking on, and actually persuaded people who had started that trend to kind of change course and to do more like the generosity type videos. Mm-hmm. So I think at least in the next generation, there's a lot of evidence that the battle is being won and that actually good things are in many cases becoming more infectious than nastiness. Like it seems like an absurd project when you first glance at it, but it actually is happening and there's things you can learn, so much you can learn from Mr. Beast.
I haven't studied Mr. Beast. I'm aware of him. I have a 9-year-old son, so I'm definitely aware of Mr. Beast, and I've seen some of his more high-profile videos. So I don't have enough ammunition or information to say anything super positive or super critical, although I've seen some other online folks do what might be dismissed as ostentatiously generous things to make videos go viral. And I do get a little bit of discomfort. Having said that, I think I come around to what you're talking about here, which is it's better to be making generosity cool than to be making food waste cool or cruelty cool or any other potential human attribute.
I mean, you can definitely cross the line. There was a video I mentioned in the book about someone who they gave flowers to a lady on a bench or whatever, filmed it. She seemed grateful. This video went viral. But then she saw how the video was done and she felt completely exploited by it. They hadn't asked her permission for anything. And so she was really upset by it, and they'd edit it, you know, in an unfair way and so forth. So you can, like, generosity purely for views that doesn't respect the recipients of the generosity. That, I think, is a key distinction there. I've met the man who runs Mr. Beast Philanthropy. I've been persuaded that he is in himself, his motivations are to do good in the world, that the money he's making will all get recycled back in. And that I think he's very much on the right side of that line.
So the book, if I'm understanding it correctly, you'll hopefully tell me if I'm not, is operating on at least two levels. One is helping us as individuals think about how we can have a generosity mindset in our own lives. And then also helping us think structurally about how we can make generosity more infectious. Would that be accurate? Okay.
Yes.
So let's just start with the individual and then we'll ladder up to the macro. Is that cool with you?
Yes. Yes.
Okay. So if I, Dan, am convinced, and I am, by everything you've said about the benefits to me of developing a generosity mindset, and if I believe you, and I do, that it doesn't make me in some way corrupt if I have some strand of self-interest flowing through my generosity, what are the basic steps towards setting up a generosity mindset?
I think it can start as early as dealing with some stuff in your own head. So, and you played a role here at Dan, you're featured in the book, because you gave this TED talk describing what it was like to give yourself permission to love yourself, to get rid of the hatred that some people feel for themselves. You went through your own intense experience and described it in a hilarious way, if I may say so. And by the way, that is such a gift. Anything that can be done with humor is going to go more viral, by the way. So it starts right there. Like if someone's sitting there feeling they're fundamentally deeply ashamed or disappointed in themselves, it's very hard to be generous in that state of mind. So watch your talk, you know, deal with that, find some way of dealing with that. You may even be able to do it without going on a 2-month retreat or whatever. I think that the essential next step is just is gratitude. It's finding a gratitude habit. And there are so many things that when you take a breath and take a step back that you can feel grateful to what? To God, to the universe for, or to other people for. And most people start with the obvious stuff of, well, I'm so grateful for my kids or my parents or my friends or whatever. But we live in an amazing time. And there's, you know, my favorite story that happened at TED was when we asked a new employee, said, what are you grateful for? He said, yeah, people I love and so forth. But really what I'm grateful for is distributed electricity. It's everywhere. How incredible is that? And it's incredible. We're all within 10 feet of a little plug in a socket you can put a wire into and a machine will clean your house or will clean your dishes or will warm you up or will cool you down. Or like, it's amazing. The fact that we live in these bodies and can experience the world around us in all its beauty, and it's different every day. You know, you get a free multimedia show every day. And if you stop and just think about that and look at that. Anyway, so whatever means it is, like for me, I don't do this every day, but I'm glad every day that I do it. Just remembering two or three new things to be grateful for. You know, being grateful is thinking about something that we have been given by the universe. So you want to respond to that. I want to give back. And so that's the fundamental start point. And from that point, there are just many different things you can do with that. And we can talk about some of them because they are literally available to anyone in different degrees. Yeah, it's like pick your choice, find the right way that you can be generous. But I think it starts with gratitude.
This is something I said to you before we started rolling, that the cliche is you can't pour from an empty cup. Mm-hmm. So if you're interested in developing a generosity mindset, the first step for some people can be a big one, which is developing some gratitude, no matter how objectively terrible aspects of modern life or your own personal life may be, developing some gratitude and developing a certain lightness, sense of humor, sense of affection for yourself.
Yes.
These are no small matters.
It's no small matters. And I guess a question I have, is there a catch-22 there? Like just occasionally, people might be stuck there thinking, I'm a horrible person, so I can't do this. When actually, if you just started with a little teeny generosity experiment, it actually might change how you think of yourself. I mean, it is one of the amazing things that happens through being generous, is that you feel better about yourself. You discover, wait a sec, am I discovering my better self? How cool is that? So I think it's possible that part of the process of learning to love yourself is to just try, even if you're not sure, and even if you don't particularly feel like it.
Two comments are coming to mind based on everything you've just said. One is, another person I've been deeply influenced by is the Buddha. And the Buddha explicitly taught generosity even before he taught meditation, I believe, that generosity was, for at least some members of his community, the key first practice to open you up, to teach you to let go. I mean, that is the end point of the Buddhist path, is letting go in a world where everything is changing all the time. Clinging is the source of unhappiness, so letting go is the answer. The second thing that came to mind is, you know, I have a deep and sometimes not very helpful allergy to cliche. And yesterday I was having a conversation with a friend who called because he's having a personal crisis of medical stuff in his family. And I didn't know what advice I was going to, if I had anything useful to say, but my first step is usually just to listen for a while and ask some probing questions. And what became clear in the conversation was this situation that he's in is terrible. And it is starting to remind him in small ways that he was overlooking, but that I helped him to focus on, that he has the capacity to be helpful and useful, and that that actually might be a counter argument against the habitual long-running story he'd been telling himself that he was a wretch and an addict and a horrible person. And I think generosity can do this for us. It can get us out of our ancient storylines and help us to tell a new story. This is the cliche that I'm allergic to. There's a poem about reminding a thing of its loveliness. And that, I think, is... And please tell me if you agree or disagree. I think that is one of the roles of generosity.
Absolutely. I mean, there's lots of ways to be kind. And some of the ones that I speak about in the book is, I mean, once you know, there's definitely, you know, giving attention and just noticing someone and listening and so forth. But maybe it all starts there. And then obvious things like, you know, you can volunteer time and so forth. But I think one of the ways of being generous right now that matters a lot is people being willing to bridge. We're in a world of so much division. People have stopped listening to each other. We sort of distrust each other. Even in a small way, just for example, in your online experience, just being willing to say, wait a sec, there's some common ground here. Or again, to listen, to be respectful and so forth. People who can do that, I view as modern heroes. A really cool way to be generous is to share some of your contacts with people. Like, we forget how much of our life is, you know, we're part of these communities of resources and so forth. If you give someone, thoughtfully give them access to some part of that, that can be a gift that takes you 10 minutes and changes their life. One of the best things about generosity is that you can think of it's asymmetric. Often the benefit to the receiver is vastly greater than the cost to the giver. You know, like every time a rich person gives money to a poor person, costs the rich person nothing, transforms the poor person's life. It's like, so why the hell don't we do more of that? You know, or the gift of enchantment, you know, someone who's creative, especially in the era we're in now, the connected area, you can bring beauty to many people. Or the gift of hospitality. One problem with the connected age is that we're forgetting the joy of in-person, just humans sitting with humans and discovering the deeper things about ourselves. So many good things happen when a group of people come together. And one special side benefit is that it allows you to imagine generosity as a team game. So for example, if you did nothing else as a result of this, how about inviting a group of friends around? Just have dinner, hang out, whatever. But maybe ask the question, hey, is there anything that we all care about? Like, what do you care about? What do you care about? Maybe there's some project you could work on together, locally or whatever. These are all sort of simple, very natural, you know, human ways to give. But if you do it, chances are surprising things will happen as a result.
So in terms of developing a generosity mindset, step one is take a look at and start to treat in some gentle way any sense of inner impoverishment you may feel.
Yes.
The second is take a look at the vast universe of options for generosity and see which ones are a fit for you.
Yeah, absolutely. And if someone feels, oh, I'm too busy for any of these sort of human things, but I do have some money, then there's another whole set of questions you can ask, which is how to spend that wisely. You know, most people's philanthropy is often just driven by impulse. You get some guilt moment, you see some crisis on TV or whatever, or some GoFundMe thing, and you sort of hastily send a payment. really, there's a difference in effectiveness of orders of magnitude, I would say, between some ways of spending money charitably and others. It's a really interesting and ultimately a joyful process to investigate that and to try to find the things that are more effective, to try to find ways of spending money that carry with them leverage, like a piece of technology can turn $100 into $1 million, or, you know, knowledge has huge leverage behind it. So funding education, for example, may be the right thing for some people, or funding some effort to put pressure on the government to release the vast sums that it has. People will find different types of leverage, but taking the time to think about that, about what will be effective, I think is a really, really cool thing to do.
We don't need to go too deep on this, but any recommendations for people who have some extra dollars to give away and may want to figure out the most effective ways to do it?
I mean, I think it starts with what types of things are you most concerned about. I mean, if you are someone who could become interested in another part of the world, for example, I would say look there, because your dollars will go a lot further. Costs are lower, and a lot of the problems that have been eliminated in the West or in the North are not yet solved there. And so that the sort of low-hanging fruit, it costs 50 cents or less to do a deworming procedure for a kid in Africa whose whole ability to be educated and to grow is being stunted or spoiled by the fact that they've got a belly full of worms. And like more than 100 million kids have this. And so this is something which philanthropy can address, for example. And there's so many amazing organizations overseas who are achieving incredible amounts with their money. But there's also a lot to be said for doing something on your doorstep, especially if you want to get involved more personally and so forth. I think it's finding the area. GiveWell is one of the websites that has tried to make an effort at looking at which charities are most effective. But there's plenty of other resources that perhaps go even deeper on things like, can this organization achieve real system change, etc. But I think start with curiosity, go on a research journey and see where it takes you. And we've built a little AI called TIG, the Infectious Generosity Guru, that you could talk to it and it will help you plan your generosity journey in a charming way and perhaps hallucinate a bit less than some of the other AIs can.
Where do we find TIG?
TIG, it's infectiousgenerosity.org.
That's very helpful. You raised a question at the beginning of this conversation that I made a note that I wanted to come back to, and now seems like the time. You talked about feeling like it's horrible if you spent $5 on a latte, knowing that that $5 could have potentially helped somebody else. Where do you net out on that personally? Do you still drink lattes?
I do. So I've spent a lot of time thinking about this, and I've ended up in a place here. Like there's a chapter of the book devoted to this called The Pledge That Could Change Everything. The start point was, if you're going to have a set of moral principles that you widely circulate, you can't have moral principles that make life hell for people, that don't have a chance of being adopted. Moral principles have to have a realistic view of what humans are capable of. Because you want your moral principles not just to be for saints, you want them to be widely adopted. So that was one step. A second was to look at what has actually happened in the past. Like religions, for example, have for hundreds of years tried to put moral obligations on their followers, including obligations around money that they spend. And where they've ended up is, I mean, Judaism and Christianity ended up with this tithing tradition, which is to give 10% of your income. Islam has as one of its pillars, zakat, they call it, which is to give away 1/40, 2.5% of your total wealth every year. So I tried this thought experiment in the book. I said, what if we said to people, one, okay, say you're not religious, do you want your moral principles to be at least as good as those of the old religious traditions? I think most people would say, well, yes, I think so. Well, in that case, how about this? How about you take a pledge, which is to do the harder of those two things, 10% of your income or 2.5% of your net worth annually. Now then, this is not something that someone who's just come out of college can do with a lot of debt, or there's a lot of people who aren't in a position where they can do that. But people who are basically comfortably off and who have been thinking about this, what would happen if those people took that pledge? So then I ran the math. If only a third of those people took that pledge, which like in my sort of optimistic view, I could picture gradually it becoming a norm among a third of the people who could do it. It would actually raise $3.5 trillion of philanthropy annually. So I went to a woman called Natalie Cargill, who has an organization called Longview Philanthropy, and said, Natalie, what could the world do with $3.5 trillion of extra philanthropy annually? And what she came back with took my breath away. Because basically, you take every single big problem that we care about right now, that amount of money can tackle it. Like if we had that much philanthropy, you wouldn't need any more philanthropy. What you would need is an incredible global execution effort on how to spend it. Mm. Philanthropy would not be the bottleneck. And so I ended up with this, at least to me, a satisfying argument that saying that that pledge of 2.5%, the higher of 2.5% of your net worth or 10% of income is a good thing to do. It is also enough. It is enough. You don't have to feel guilty beyond that. Now, for me, that is a powerful argument because it allows me to joyfully take that pledge and then live my life and be happy about it. And I think that I'm not the only person who is daunted by starting a generosity journey, especially when it comes to writing checks, because of this exact fear that there's no end to it. You can never enjoy another latte. No, you can enjoy another latte. But if you can see a pathway to building up, maybe over several years, but building up to that pledge, I think that's enough. I think that's all the world needs from us in terms of financial generosity. And so that's the argument I make. And it's possibly self-serving. And maybe I'm just trying to relieve my own guilt. And maybe it's also, in many cases, a pipe dream. But the thing is, like we look at the very rich and we critique them, you know, big donor philanthropy is sort of viewed with cynicism. You know, my belief there is that the problem isn't that people that rich are being philanthropic, it's that they're not being nearly philanthropic enough. Mm. If they were to give away 2.5% of their net worth annually, it would probably triple what they're currently doing on average. And it would make a huge difference in the world. What I would love to see happen is that we move from this discussion about cynicism about billionaire philanthropy, for example, and try and move it towards more, no, let's dream about what that could actually achieve, because what that could achieve is actually amazing. This is a legitimate conversation, not just for billionaires, for the whole world to be thinking about. All that private capital is sitting there. Yes, we should tax it differently. Go work on that. I'd love you to achieve that. While you're doing that, there's $13 trillion sitting there. Let's put it to use. Let's put it to use.
I think where I'm getting hung up is not on that at all. Where I get hung up is around, okay, so 10% of annual income or 2.5 of net worth. I'm not proud of this, but if I think about how my wife and I are running our family finances, we cut it so close to the bone that if we were to make a pledge like this, which I find very attractive, it would throw us into disarray. And I can't imagine I'm alone on this.
I think that's a completely legitimate response. What I think is good is for people to start somewhere. I think studies have shown that even the very poorest in many cultures give away 1% of what they have. And so start there, 1% or 2%, and hope over time that you can raise it. There's a website, givingwhatwecan.org, that allows you to register a pledge at any level. Hmm. But just the act of pledging something flips you then from random acts of charity on impulse to a plan. You make a plan, like, what do I actually care about? And so just start somewhere and see whether it can grow.
What I imagine you do not want is for people to listen to this and say, well, shit, there's no way I can get to 10% or 2.5% right now. So I'm just not going to think about it. I assume what you're saying is, no. Hear that as aspirational.
Yes.
Hear that as a thing maybe you could build to over time. And where can you start now? And by the way, there's a lot in this for you.
Yeah, exactly. It turns out that the process of going down this route brings joy with it. It could bring your family together. It is its own fuel. And these are levels that religions have for years been insisting that their flocks do. People have found a way to do it. Often that money has gone into the church, say, and may have been, who knows whether it's been well spent. But the point is that people often did give at that level and were proud to do so. To me, it's exciting to picture a world where some of that comes back. Because if it came back at scale, it is genuinely amazing what could be achieved with that money. I'd love it in part to be pulled by us rethinking, wow, if societies were more generous, we really could solve some of the things that we're stuck on.
Much more of my conversation with Chris Anderson after this. Audible lets you enjoy all your audio entertainment in one app. You will always find the best of what you love or something new to discover. They offer an incredible selection of audiobooks across every genre, from bestsellers and new releases to celebrity memoirs, mysteries and thrillers, motivation, wellness, business, and more. The book I've been checking out recently is called Our Share of Night. It's technically, I guess, a horror, but it's definitely literature. I mean, it's incredibly well written, absolutely fascinating. And it really does rhyme with some of the themes that we explore on this show. I highly recommend it, although I'm only through the first 15-20% of it, but already I highly recommend it. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from the entire catalog, including the latest bestsellers and new releases. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/10%. Or text 10% to 500-500. That's audible.com/10%. Or text 10% to 500-500 to try Audible free for 30 days. audible.com/10%. I love cats. I make no secret of that. We've got four cats. But here's the thing about felines. They poop a lot. You need kitty litter, and you need that kitty litter to do the job. Which is why I'm proud to recommend Tidy Care Alert, which has long-lasting ammonia control. So your house or your apartment or your yurt or wherever you live does not smell like you have four cats or however many cats you happen to have. No judgment here. It's low dust and lightweight, which means no lugging heavy bags of cat litter up the stairs. And it's from the brand most often recommended and personally used by veterinarians. Tidy Care Alert uses color-changing crystals to detect potential concerns and help put your mind at ease. Let Tidy Care Alert help keep an eye on your cat's health.
We just talked about how to establish a generosity mindset and then some thoughts about how to act on it. Let's talk about the infectious generosity of it all, how to harness the features of modern life in order to make our generosity even more impactful. You list in the book five ways to make your giving go viral. Maybe that's a good place for us to start.
Sure. So a lot of this is just paying attention to the people who have actually been successful at it. So like a Mr. Beast and others. And some of the things that you see when you do it and that make a lot of sense to me. I mean, the first one is just to, if you do something that unlocks human emotion in some way, that is the fundamental engine of virality. People see something, they feel something, they want to share it. That's basically how it goes. That's why the Mr. Beast videos, you watch those, people feel excited or whatever, and so they share it. And any kind of emotion is possible here. It's not just the traditional charity emotions of look at this poor suffering child or animal. It's others as well, like laughter can do it. You know, if you remember the ice bucket challenge, that was mm-hmm. hilarious. Mm-hmm. And it was basically laughter that, you know, spread that. And so, you know, spreading a sense of wonder or all this sort of stuff can help. So emotion. Two, creativity. The wilder the better. You know, often we're very earnest and sort of serious in how we describe generosity and that kind of kind world. And it makes it boring. What if you did it differently? So one of the examples I give in the book is of this team of friends in Japan who wanted to clean up the streets. They dressed up in samurai costumes and did this with incredible style. It's like the sword slashes into the plastic bottle, flips it up in the air, and they catch it with the basket, and videoed this, of course. And these videos go viral, and it sparked thousands of other groups forming and wanting to pick up litter. So creativity did that. And it's the second piece. Courage is a huge deal. Tell the story of Daryl Davis, who was puzzled why lots of people, he's an African-American musician, he was puzzled why some people didn't like him because of the color of his skin. He invited the local leader of the Ku Klux Klan to a meeting. And very tense meeting, but it led to another meeting. He ended up even going to KKK rallies. They built a friendship. Eventually, this man left the KKK. Many others did as well. His story was picked up and went worldwide. Why? Because this is courage. It's like, wow, he did that? That's amazing. So courage, creativity together, there's a word for those two things combined, which is audacious. It's like being bold, you know, taking a risk, doing stuff that is surprising. So I think that's really the core engine. And then beyond that, teaming up with people, collaborate, do it with a group of friends. And there's obvious virality just in that you've got a lot more people at the party doing their thing. And then if you can, in some cases, not everyone can do this, but build some kind of amplifier. So Catherine Barrett noticed someone during the pandemic who put a box of tissues and said, please take one. And she took a picture of it, put it on a Facebook group. She called the group The Kindness Pandemic. And 500,000 people ended up joining this group, all telling their own stories. So even a Facebook group can be this massive amplifier of kindness, whether it's a website, a hashtag. There's lots of ways that different people have built things that have ended up just astonishing. But don't start there. Start with, you know, the act of kindness and just take a moment extra to say, is there a more fun way that we could do this? Can we do this with a little more delight or boldness or, you know? And if you do, there's a much better chance that other people will notice and come along for the ride.
I thought it would be fun and maybe a little self-serving to ask you while you're here about a germ of an idea that I have along these lines and see if we can figure it out together.
Let's think.
So this would be an idea that would involve this show and my community. My family were by no means super wealthy or anything like that. My parents were doctors, so we were upper middle class and very comfortable. But we were, you know, I'm not talking about billionaire philanthropy here at all. When my grandmother, who was by no means high income, when she passed away 15 years ago, my parents took what was left in her bank account and started something called the Harris Family Foundation. I think it was like $100,000 that she had to her name when she died. And then my parents started putting money into it over time. And we would get together as a family and decide where we wanted to spend this every year. Now my parents are not able to run it anymore. So my brother and I have taken it over. And my brother, who has recently gotten interested in meditation, had the idea that we should focus this entire foundation on bringing mindfulness and or the Dharma to underserved communities. So we have this foundation. I've never talked about it publicly before. We've been giving, but kind of giving under the old idea that I learned in Hebrew school of, you know, if you talk about it, you've corrupted the whole enterprise. So I think now, in part from looking at your materials and having conversations with my brother, we've had the idea to, like, let's make it public and let's get people who listen to the show or follow me in some way to also give, not to the foundation, but to the organizations that we've vetted and are supporting and are making our support public on. So I'll stop talking. I'm curious to hear if you have any thoughts based on the conversation we're having.
Well, first of all, I'm really moved that you would share it, because that first step of doing what is an uncomfortable thing of, you know, talking about your own foundation and what, you know, we do find that hard. And I think the rules around that should change. And that the fact that you're saying this right now will, I suspect, have ripple effects that in a couple of years' time, you think, wow, so that was worth doing then, right? So thank you, honestly, for having the courage to do that. I mean, look, there's so many ways you could go. One is to engage your audience with the creativity part of it. It's like, what do you think? Like, have an email address people could write to and just say, if you like this idea, I think you're onto something, but you've got suggestions about who we should support, how we might amplify it, bring them in. I mean, you've got this incredible reach from the podcast. Is there an organization you could partner with where you could do a feed that actually helps people directly? Like, use this amazing connection and the feed you have to say, here's a free lesson or a free attempt at your own kind of meditation or mindfulness or whatever. There's obviously lots of people have tried versions of that. But it depends how crazy you want to be, right? Like, you could invite people to say, could you spend money to advance this cause somehow? Don't tell me how. Just tell me how much you need. And you pick one or two at random and you take a risk on them and give them the money and see what happens and say, all you have to do is tell me the story. What I've found is that in many cases, just letting it go, it can be amazing what happens next. There's risk in it. It doesn't always work, but it's the kind of crazy thing that you could try that in itself might get buzz and might get, like, if it led to something. I mean, you won't believe how we found this person, you know?
I love that. So basically saying, hey, if you think you've got some clever idea for delivering mindfulness or meditation or the Dharma to people who otherwise wouldn't hear it. The crazier the better. Propose it to me, and we'll take a look at the greatest submissions. And if we the ones we like, we'll give you $50,000, and you can go or $10,000, whatever it is, and you can go make it happen. The only thing we ask is document it, and let's turn it into a story.
That's right. And I think there's a trade-off. Like traditionally, at one end, that's a grant proposal. You know, make your grant pitch to us, and it's 200 pages, and you've told us every last detail, and we'll have 7 meetings, and then maybe we'll write you the check. That's one way to go, which minimizes the risk of a disaster. The other way to go is to do super light touch and say, tell us your big idea, and on one sheet of paper, 3 reasons why you think you're going to be successful. And we're going to take the top 5, and then we'll give one a big check at random or whatever. Like you could, by going lighter touch, you may be surprised at what comes back because it allows more potential for surprise and for ownership. I mean, again, we've just been astonished at this every stage of the way at TED, whereby by letting go of control of these TEDx events, they have done things that we could never have imagined. Mm-hmm. They have done, okay, we'll do TEDx in a prison. We're going to do TEDx in a refugee camp. We're going to do it inside a rainforest and bring people out so that they're actually in it. It's like, you could do that? I never thought of that. That's incredible. And yet they do it. So we've been constantly amazed and delighted by what's happened just by letting go. But the main thing I'd say, Dan, is kudos for opening it up. Like just doing that, people are going to contact you with ideas and it will put you on a journey that, you know, you probably won't be able to stop. You know, it'll lead to something.
I love it. Before I let you go, I do want to talk about, we mentioned before that the book is working on a couple levels. We've spent a lot of time by design on my side on the individual level. What can we do to develop a generosity mindset? But the book also talks about what can be done structurally to make our society more generous. Mm. We're not going to be able to get to all of your big arguments and big ideas in the book, but what comes to mind as being worth sharing in whatever time remains?
To me, the biggest thing that's gone wrong on the internet, and especially social media, is that it's been designed based on a naive view of human nature. It's been designed as if humans were basically fully in control of their lives, and that if you just optimize for user choice, you're going to have a nice outcome. Whereas I think the way we should think of ourselves, at a minimum, is of these complex creatures with an instinctive self and a reflective self. And much of life is a battle between those two selves. And I think the reason why people meditate and so forth is to try to give power to their reflective selves. It's our reflective selves that will tell us on our deathbed whether we're proud of the lives that we lived. And it's our reflective selves that whisper to us every so often, you're doing it. You're okay. You're happy. This is what happiness is. So online, that this battle to take back the internet as a force for good in society, I think will largely be won on whether or not we can empower people's reflective selves. Because our addictive selves or our doom-scrolling selves or whatever are always going to get pulled into the easier, the more sort of visceral, primal feelings of mistrust, anger, you know, all these things. They are more powerful, unfortunately, in human psychology than the other feelings of generosity and kindness. There's an instinct to them, but they need to be amplified by reflective, deliberate, proactive intention. So that's what it's about. And there's stuff that we can do by paying attention to that and carefully curating how we spend our time online, who we follow, finding that generosity mindset, contributing to the good conversations, and finding the people. There are so many people online who are doing beautiful things. Support them financially, just amplify them, like them, you know, like repost them, whatever. There's so much we can do just as individuals there. And then there's a lot that the platforms can and must do in terms of empowering that reflective self. So one example is, so just on X, where I spend some time, you know, Elon Musk has publicly committed to saying the goal here is to maximize unregretted user minutes. Regret is a function of the reflective mind. If he's serious about that, there is a pathway where X can become a wholesome place. Some people will say that it already is showing signs of that. There's a debate raging on its future. But it's that kind of thing that is necessary. We need to, you know, on TikTok in China, attention breaks are built in, especially for kids. After a bit, it says, what your mother says, stop, count to 10. Now respond. And you know, that brings your reflective self to the table. Just encouraging voice communication over weaponized text snippets is powerful. different parts of our biology are triggered. It's much, much harder to be really mean and nasty to someone when you're speaking to them face to face than when you're texting them anonymously.
Yes.
So fundamentally, that's the lens that I think it takes, is how do we empower our reflective selves?
You mentioned Elon Musk. I think a lot of people would argue that he is expressing insufficient regret for his X moments, you know, that he's said a lot of things that seem unhinged on X.
Yeah, I think that's probably fair. He's a very complex man. He's got a lot of internal demons, as he himself would say. Part of him really does want to use the platform for the betterment of humanity. He feels passionately about this whole woke mind virus and the need to, you know, the damage that he believes that has caused. And I think there's a personal family reason why some of that has happened. Some of the company that he's formed in tackling that is unpleasant, certainly to people on the left. Who knows how that plays out? But that unregretted use of minutes as a target is valid. That is the right target. And the other thing that I think is helpful on X is community notes, which is this crowd-created thing where people will identify if a post has gone up that it contains inaccuracies or is really toxic, you know, that they'll say, actually, here's some broader context. They're doing that really quickly before often posts have really sort of escaped and gone viral. I think that's hopeful that they didn't have that before, and that is definitely an improvement. I've seen many cases of some of the nastiest stuff getting sort of pulled back. But look, a lot of people still hate that platform, still hate some of the other platforms. There's a huge battle to be won here. I actually believe that it can be won. I think that enough people working in those companies are themselves passionate about wanting to do work for the good of humanity, not the bad of humanity. And I think there's new insights being learned all the time. There's brilliant people like Tristan Harris and Eli Paris and others out there who are sort of working on this problem. I think we'll learn how to fix it. And of course, there's AI is the wild card here, and that's a whole other topic. One reason why I feel urgency about trying to do some repair on the internet is that AIs are developing their wisdom from the internet.
Right.
You know, what version of humanity do we want them to learn?
Just in closing here, I want to say something on mic that I said to you off mic before we started rolling here about TED and my experience there. And you can respond if you want, and hopefully it's not too embarrassing, but for you to get gushed at here. But my first experience at TED was in 2022, where I actually saw you do perhaps the most thoughtful interview I've ever seen with Elon Musk, actually. I gave a talk that year. But I think the more moving experience for me was going back in 23, where I was not giving a talk and so didn't have that stress and was just there to volunteer and help the speakers get ready for their talks. And there is, this is your term, a kind of generosity economy at play at TED that I'd never experienced a community like that before, where, you know, I could come and meet these incredible people and help them do a better job at getting their ideas out to the world. And how astonishingly rewarding that was for me to not only get to play that small role, but also to be part of this community. I had watched TED Talks, of course, but had not experienced what I believe to be the even more substantial magic of the organization until going. So I say all that by way of kudos to you, because it is an act of generosity to have established and run this organization over time and to continue to do it. So thank you.
Well, that's very kind of you. If you haven't seen Dan's TED Talk, you should go out and watch that, because it's already, I mean, it's been deeply meaningful to a lot of people, including a close personal friend of mine who was really transformed by the notion of finding a way to forgive himself for certain things. And yeah, we don't always get it right at TED, but it does start with generosity. Like the generosity of speakers coming, it's the number one thing we say to them when you come to the stage. Don't use this as a way to promote your company or self. Use it to give a gift of an idea, and potentially like the right idea at the right moment for the right person. That just might be the most important gift they ever had, because it can change their life forever. So anyway, so thank you for what you said.
My pleasure. Thanks for coming on the show. It's so fun to have you.
Been a delightful conversation. Thank you.
Before I let you go, can you just remind it, because you, the new book is called Infectious Generosity. If people want to learn more, the website is?
Yeah, it's infectiousgenerosity.org.
And it's TED.org as well.
Funnily enough, it's TED.com. TED is a nonprofit, but
okay.
The main website is, we have TED.org, but the main website is TED.com.
Okay. Anything else that we should, I know we just talked about not promoting, but is there anything else that we should promote here while you're here?
No. I just, some aspects of generosity are really annoying. What I really hope happens is that people find the part that isn't annoying for them, embrace it, and get joy from it. That's what I hope.
Amen.
Yeah. All right. Thank you.
Thanks again to Chris Anderson. We've done several other episodes where we touch on the issue of generosity. I'll put some links to those in the show notes if you want to go deeper on this. 10% Happier is produced by Lauren Smith, Gabrielle Zuckerman, Justine Davey, and Tara Anderson. DJ Kashmir is our senior producer. Marissa Schneiderman is our senior editor. Kevin O'Connell is our director of audio and post-production. And Kimmy Regler is our executive producer. Alicia Mackey leads our marketing. And Tony Magyar is our director of podcasts. Nick Thorburn of Islands wrote our theme. If you like 10% Happier, and I hope you do, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Once upon a beat. Remember those stories and fables that would capture your imagination and you couldn't wait to see how they would unfold? And now, when you read them as an adult, you think, some of these old tales could use a fresh spin. We have a perfect podcast to bring you the stories you remember, remix, and reimagine for the kids in your life today. Join me, DJ Fuse, and my trusty turntable, Baby Scratch, as we spin up new tales in the New Kids and Family Podcast, Once Upon a Beat. Yeah. Wondery and Tinkercast are bringing you a jam-packed, music-filled weekly party where hip-hop and fables meet. It's Once Upon a Beat. Follow Once Upon a Beat on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to Once Upon a Beat early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Wondery Kids Plus in Apple Podcasts. Once Upon a Beat.
For more than two centuries, the White House has been the stage for some of the most dramatic scenes in American history. Inspired by the hit podcast American History Tellers, Wondery and William Morrow present the new book, The Hidden History of the White House. Each chapter will bring you inside the fierce power struggles, the world-altering decisions, and shocking scandals that have shaped our nation. You'll be there when the very foundations of the White House are laid in 1792, and you'll watch as the British burn it down in 1814. Then you'll hear the intimate conversations between FDR and Winston Churchill as they make plans to defeat Nazi forces in 1941. And you'll be in the Situation Room when President Barack Obama approves the raid to bring down the most infamous terrorist in American history. Pre-order The Hidden History of the White House now in hardcover or digital editions wherever you get your books.